HPR News. It is now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. We're all familiar with what a utility is, a regulated business providing a vital public good like water or electricity, a company allowed to make money, but not in such a way that makes access to that public good difficult or unaffordable. But when it comes to the internet, our guest today says those problems of access and affordability are quite real, with Americans paying higher prices for worse service than customers in other countries. And that's because, she says, our government has let a few giant companies dominate the market with almost no rules. We're talking with Susan Crawford. She's a well-known tech policy expert, now a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. Her new book is called Captive Audience: The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. Crawford argues that internet providers should be treated like regulated utilities, given the vast importance of their service to our lives today. Her book also reflects rising fears about threats to so-called net neutrality, the idea that all online content should be treated equally in terms of access and cost. Today in The Exchange, we explore these ideas with Susan Crawford, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Susan Crawford joins us from Harvard Law. And Professor Crawford, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
You're so welcome.
Well, before we get into all the policy and the problems that you see with internet access that you outline in the book, let's just get down to basics if we could. How do the vast majority of Americans, Professor Crawford, get access to the internet right now?
Well, most Americans are getting access to the internet through their local cable provider. We used to do this over the phone line, copper phone lines, in the past. Dial-up was the first way of doing it, and then cable modem service showed up over cable attachments to people's homes. Today, the phone companies have basically backed off. They're basically wireless companies at this point, and cable by far dominates the provision of internet access in America. And each local cable company is, in fact, a monopoly in most parts of the country.
So DSL is that old-fashioned dial-up service that you're saying almost nobody has anymore. Is that right?
Well, actually, dial-up is dial-up. That was over an unfixed phone line, unmodified phone line. DSL comes a little later. It's over a copper line, and it actually is a dedicated always-on service. You're not dialing in. But it has become the new dial-up. People are fleeing it because it doesn't have enough capacity or speed for the kinds of things people want to do today.
And that was provided by the phone companies as well, is that right? The DSL?
That's right. So DSL was just an enhanced use of the old-fashioned copper phone wire. It's still in place in many parts of the United States, but where cable is available, cable is taking about 90% of new high-speed internet access subscriptions, so it's very popular.
Well, and DSL is still an issue in some rural parts of New Hampshire, so we may hear from some of those folks today about internet access in remote corners of our state. So we had dial-up, then DSL. Now most people get it through cable. A lot of people are talking about Fios, though, Professor Crawford. What's that?
Well, Fios is Verizon's nickname for its fiber optic service, but the important thing to think about is the nature of the medium. Fiber optic is very thin, slender glass tubes through which lasers are shot, and fiber is future-proof, we believe, for the next 50 years or so. It's unlimited capacity. You can put 90,000 simultaneous phone calls through a single strand of glass fiber. Many other countries around the world are making the upgrade from old-fashioned copper wire to fiber. We've gotten stuck on this cable plateau because of consolidation and lack of policy involvement by our government. So there's very little fiber connection in America. Verizon Fios is going to cover about 14% of Americans when they're completely done. There's a little bit going on from Google Fiber, which is exciting, but they're only planning at the moment to cover about 3% of American households. Meanwhile, cable covers 93%. So we're stuck.
Well, and I'm going to ask you in just a minute about why we're stuck, and that's a lot of what your book is about. But I was so intrigued, Professor Crawford, by comparisons with other industrialized nations, South Korea, France, a bunch of other European countries, Japan. You say that customers there pay far, far less for far better service.
Yes. In fact, I've made some personal quests to these places just to feel what it's like. And I went to Stockholm over Christmas break, and I made a new friend there. The leading senior online citizen of Sweden is a guy named Bertil Nordström. He's 93 years old. He wrote to me yesterday saying, "Susan, have you fixed the situation in America yet? I get gigabit access, which is 100 times faster than ordinary internet access in America over fiber for $15 a month."
Wow.
Wow. And he's just urging me to go to the Rotary Clubs across America and get this situation fixed.
So 100 times faster. That almost seems,
yes,
you know, a blink of the eye.
Right. And that's the salient difference. You've put your finger on it, that people in Sweden and South Korea and Japan and these other sensible countries don't think about communications capacity at all. It's just there. It's unquestioned. It's essentially unlimited. It's reasonably priced. It's not a drag on anything they do. We're stuck sort of driving around hunting for an open Wi-Fi signal or hoping that we can upload our pictures and waiting for things to happen. That's not going on in these other places.
Okay, so here's the big question. How come? Why are we stuck on these copper wires when everybody else is moving ahead at lightning speed?
We're stuck because we decided about 10 years ago that competition would protect Americans. We didn't need to have any form of regulatory oversight of high-speed internet access. And at the time, DSL, that old-fashioned copper wire technology we talked about at the beginning, was head-to-head competing with cable modem service. And so we thought that that would keep prices down and, you know, protect consumers. Since then, though, the phone companies have found out that it's quite expensive to upgrade their copper lines to fiber at the same time that the cable guys have been able to upgrade their cable plants to pretty high capacity download services. So long story short, there's been enormous consolidation in cable. Cable now occupies the field for most Americans and has a monopoly service. And the phone companies have retreated to the higher, safer ground of wireless services, where they're still making enormous profits and they can divide those markets. So in the absence, it turns out that where consolidation is possible, competition is impossible. And we've ended up with a stagnant market for high-speed internet access.
So the cable companies have no interest in investing in Fios because they've, you know, they're sitting pretty now.
Right. They're under no pressure from either competition or from oversight to upgrade their plants. They're in harvesting mode. They made investments in their network a while ago, and now about 15% of the revenue they get goes into upgrading their networks. That's it. They're just sitting and making more and more money off of the same number of people.
Our phone number for you to join us on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, our guest is Susan Crawford, visiting professor at Harvard Law School, author of the new book, Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. She's also a columnist for Bloomberg View. That's part of Bloomberg News. Join us with your questions and comments about this complicated but important technical issue. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. NHPR Exchange, all one word. Well, in the book, Captive Audience, Professor Crawford, you focus a lot on Comcast. How many big cable providers dominate the market in America today and have us in this stuck situation that you talk about?
Well, Comcast is by far in the lead. They're really a behemoth. They are the largest media company in the world at this point by revenue, and they've got most of the broadband subscribers in the country. Second to them is Time Warner Cable with about 11 million subscribers. And recently, Comcast announced that it wanted to merge with Time Warner Cable, and they were very proud of the fact that these two companies don't compete in any one zip code in America. That's because quite a while ago, they divided up the country among themselves. They never enter each other's footprints. They called it the summer of love when they clustered their systems and swapped operations to make that possible. So we're led by Comcast for high-speed internet access, Time Warner Cable second, And then there are a lot of Americans, about 33%, who are still using DSL. And in those markets, I predict that cable is going to get all those subscribers eventually.
Wait, there's no other cable providers but Comcast and Time Warner Cable? That's it?
Well, there's also Cox and Charter. They're much smaller, with about 4 million subscribers each. Cablevision around New York City. And some local actors, very small ones in the rest of the country. But the top four or five providers account for 90% of broadband subscribers in America.
90%?
Yeah, it's a very concentrated market.
Let's take some comments and thoughts from our listeners, Professor Crawford. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Robin's calling in from Dublin. Hi, Robin. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I was calling because I have an interesting problem. My daughter is a junior in high school, and they are very much totally telling the students that they must have internet at home. Well, we don't have internet because Fairpoint chooses not to bring it to us. It's too much trouble. They have told me this over the phone. It's too much trouble to add the 25 customers would be at the end of the road. Almost all of Dublin has internet access, and it is DSL. But they will not bring it to us. And to me, that's a utility doing whatever it feels like. And I have to agree with your guest that they shouldn't be able to do that. They shouldn't be able to tell people that we don't want to bother getting to you.
Robin, thank you for the call. And just to let you know, Professor Crawford, so she's at the end of the road, so to speak, in a small town, Dublin, a lovely town, Robin. She raises a point that is a huge, huge theme in your book. And this is the idea of telecommunications, internet access, as a utility. Just quickly give us your thoughts on that, and then we'll talk more after a break, Professor Crawford.
Well, absolutely. It's a tragedy that about a third of Americans still don't have broadband access at home. And that means that their kids can't be part of this new wave of online education. They can't get adequate health care. It's a tremendous and growing unfairness in American society.
Right.
This is a utility.
We will definitely pick up on that theme after a break. Robin, thanks a lot for joining us. You can bring your questions and comments into our discussion as well. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More conversation with Professor Susan Crawford in just a moment.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR reaches listeners all over New Hampshire. If you own or operate a business, you can get your message to the entire state by simply becoming an NHPR underwriter. Visit the support page at nhpr.org to find out more about our many underwriting opportunities. More on net neutrality and the telecom industry on the exchange, then a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. Western powers weigh responses to Russia's possible next moves. New Hampshire weather mostly sunny today, becoming less windy as the day goes on. Highs from upper 20s north, ranging upper 30s south. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, Electric, now offering electrical repair and service, in addition to furnaces, boilers, and water heaters. Online at justcallheritage.com. And Bernstein Shore, committed to practical, innovative, and entrepreneurial legal solutions for clients in New Hampshire and around the world, in Manchester and at bernsteinshore.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, our guest is Susan Crawford. She's a visiting professor at Harvard Law School, author of the new book that we're looking at called Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. She's also a columnist for Bloomberg View, part of Bloomberg News. The book is about why Americans are falling behind the rest of the world in terms of speed and access on the internet. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org is how you can join us with your questions and thoughts. You can post a comment on our Facebook page, too, if you'd like. NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So, Professor Crawford, just before the break, we got a call from Robin. Again, she's at the end of the road in a small town. She can't get internet access from her phone company, complaining about the fact that internet access is not treated like a utility. Give us a little bit more on that. You make the argument in the book that internet access has reached the point where it should be considered a utility.
This is exactly what we went through with the electrification problem in America 100 years ago. When FDR came into office, 90% of farmers didn't have electricity. And it took enormous public will to take on the special interest, the private companies that were controlling electricity. We thought water was a utility, but electricity wasn't. Now we're in this same position with high-speed internet access, which is essential to everything everybody needs to do these days. And yet, left to their own devices, private companies will systematically gouge the rich, leave out rural and poor areas, and just use every opportunity they can to serve their shareholders rather than the social interests of the entire country.
Give us a little more on that essential. Are there still some people who feel, look, it's nice to have internet access at home, but, you know, I can manage without it. If I really need it, I can, you know, go to the library or get it at work if I'm working.
Well, the problem is this is entrenching and amplifying inequality in America because educational opportunities and health services and government programs and jobs are increasingly only accessible over an online connection that's reliable and high capacity. So we have a growing digital divide internally in the country with people who don't quite get the importance of this and are being left out of all these opportunities. And then we've got a digital divide between the United States and the rest of the world, where other countries are routinely experiencing much higher capacity, reasonably priced services. So we're really drifting. We're becoming a third world nation when it comes to high-speed internet access. People from South Korea visiting here, they feel like it's a rural vacation, a calming retreat from reality. Yes, they're
really?
Not. Yes, I'm not kidding.
Because
connectivity is so poor here.
And isn't that quaint?
Right.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's interesting. And so getting back again to Robin's point, she says the educational opportunities aren't there for her daughter.
Right.
The phone company says it's, quote unquote, too much trouble to go all the way to Robin's house. So who steps in and says, you know, you can't do that anymore?
Well, the Federal Communications Commission, to its credit, is trying to expand the use of what we call universal service funds, essentially subsidizing high-cost areas to make sure they get some form of access. But this is why Verizon dumped its lines in New England and got, you know, sent a lot of them off to Frontier. They felt it was just not in their business model to serve rural areas. They're used to pleasing Wall Street with very high margins and really quick returns on anything they do. This kind of service doesn't fall naturally into that category. It is expensive to build. Its returns are very widespread and serve all of society, everything we do, and yet we're leaving it in their hands to decide who gets service and when.
So paint that picture for us, Professor Crawford, and then I have a couple more questions on that, of what internet access would look like, how it would work if it were a utility.
Well, we treated phone access the same way. So just look back to the telephone. It was our telephone system was the envy of the world when it was first built. And it was provided by a private company, but subject to lots of public burdens. So everybody gets a telephone line. Everybody gets a device that allows them to connect to the telephone. And we're all on equal terms across the country. That builds productivity, economic growth, social cohesion, artistic everything, you know. And now the substitute for the telephone is a high-speed internet access connection. It's general purpose. It's two-way. And the picture should be that everybody in the country has a very high capacity, inexpensively priced connection to the internet and a device that lets them access it. And where people can't afford it, we subsidize them.
You know, people may have their frustrations with the way things are now, and they may hear you say, gee, I'm a little envious that South Korea and France and Sweden have it better. But they may also be hearing you, Professor Crawford, and think, whoa, 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 government regulation, that's not going to make it better. It's going to make it worse.
Well, what's so interesting about this is that this is a nonpartisan issue. The free market can't function unless it has a road system in place and a communication system. Transport and communications are two places where government has to act because these sorts of services won't naturally, magically emerge from the market in ways that serve everybody at a reasonable price.
A Wall Street Journal review of your book said, so many of the well-meaning progressive reforms of yesteryear, rate regulation, price controls, led to terrible long-run outcomes for the public interest. This reviewer said, through hard-won experience, we've learned that the antitrust or regulatory responses often amounted to a failure that was worse, thwarting entrepreneurship, the emergence of new business models, often resulting in higher prices for consumers. This is what Comcast says, too, by the way. I looked at some of their responses yesterday. They say, don't get in our way or we won't be able to innovate.
Right, exactly. Comcast, over the last 5 years, made hundreds of billions of dollars and plowed a small portion of that back into their networks. They are reaping enormous returns from this north of 95% profit on their high-speed internet access services. So they've made their investments, and now they're just harvesting the rest of us. This argument is always made by, it was made by the electricity concerns back in the beginning of the 20th century, saying don't get in our way. It turns out that we wouldn't have a federal highway system, for example, without Eisenhower saying it was needed to make sure that every town in America had an ability to communicate via transport across the country. Same situation here. This doesn't emerge from private forces. Or put another way, when private actors provide a utility like this, they will reach the big towns first, and they'll charge them a lot, but a lot of people will get left out, and that entire burden will then be put on the state, which makes it more expensive.
Again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. And Professor Crawford, back to our listeners. Ken's calling in from Chelmsford, Mass. Hi, Ken, go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, no problem. It was my understanding, as per an article I saw in the New York Times, that the FCC didn't contest the ruling because they had actually been, in addition to the FCC's desire to implement net neutrality being overruled, there had been areas that the court defined as places they could put forth net neutrality. And I thought that that was something that the FCC was looking to move forward with. Is that not the case?
Thanks for the call, Ken. And let's back up before we answer Ken's question, if we could, please, Professor Crawford. Net neutrality, that's an important concept. Ken, thanks for the call.
Well, here's what happened. 10 years ago, we deregulated the sector, so we took away the utility label from high-speed internet access. And since then, in the light of all this consolidation, the Federal Communications Commission got worried that the internet access providers would be able to favor some uses of the internet over the others. That's the net neutrality problem. And so they put in place a set of rules in December 2010 called the Open Internet Order that attempts to restrain discrimination by high-speed internet access providers. The D.C. Circuit recently said you can't have it both ways. You can't both deregulate with one hand and regulate with the other. Figure out what you're up to. And the FCC is going to try to move forward, again, without calling these systems a utility, and that leaves their power really questionable as a legal matter. And so a lot of people out in the world are saying this makes no sense. Why wouldn't you treat high-speed internet access as utility, just administratively change its label? The FCC could do that. So the caller is referring to this battle right now. The big point for listeners to understand is that there is so much political power on the other side. The cable association leader has said it will be World War III if the FCC even leans towards calling this service a utility and regulating it. So we have two options. We could either try to regulate or, and I'm more optimistic about this second option, we could just build alternative networks. And lots of communities across the country are looking into municipal fiber networks that would be paid for with patient capital, bond money like a bridge, and would then not be subject to this kind of private power.
Interesting. And I definitely want to ask you about that a little bit down the road. But the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, they're the key regulators at the federal level of this. So are you saying, Professor Crawford, a decade or so ago, the government used to regulate internet access more than it does now?
Exactly. The only reason we had DSL access was because the FCC required phone companies to make their lines available for internet access on a non-discriminatory basis. That's regulation. So it took off. The private internet use took off in America because of regulation. And then we said, well, forget it. We believe the competition's going to solve all our problems. And we turned out to be wrong. And the same guy, Michael Powell, who recently said that attempting to regulate the cable industry would be World War III, is the actor that deregulated high-speed internet access as chairman of the Federal Communications Commission 10 years ago.
So give us an example, sort of an on-the-ground, your average user, of what net neutrality means and what the lack of net neutrality might mean for that same user. Just your average Joe or Jane.
So average Joe or Jane, you've probably bought a bundle of pay TV if you're a cable subscriber, both pay TV and internet access. All that stuff is going over one great big digital pipe. What if Apple made a special deal with Comcast that gave its online video service preferential treatment? That service would look great. Meanwhile, your Netflix films would be jittery and, you know, unreliable because Apple had the deal that Netflix didn't. And you'd end up continuing to pay for this cable bundle more and more, higher prices, because you couldn't cut over to online video that was being provided by actors independent of Comcast.
So preferential treatment for certain types of content.
Right. And that content might be movies today, but tomorrow it could be things like health services, access to your doctor, access to educational opportunities.
Political speech.
There is no constraint right now on what high-speed internet access providers can do to choose winners and losers. A physical story I often use for this is pretend you're the people in Fort Lee, New Jersey, trying to get across the George Washington Bridge, and someone has put traffic cones in between you and your destination. You don't know who, but you feel bullied. And that's the situation with high-speed internet access today, that services that want to reach consumers may be kneecapped, got interfered with by the internet access provider on their way down.
So there was another example that I saw. Perhaps it was even in your book, Professor Crawford. Comcast could decide to make the New York Times website harder to download, harder to look at, more annoying to look at, and make NBC's news content easy to look at because, you know, Comcast is united with NBC.
Right. And Comcast would say, look, it's not in our interest to do that. You misunderstand our intentions. But it's absolutely clear they have the power to do it. And recently, this announcement of a proposed Apple deal with Comcast, it's still a rumor. We don't have a lot of details. This really points out the power of Comcast to pick a provider of particular forms of information services and favor them.
Let's take another call if we could. This is Jim in Goffstown. Hi, Jim. You're on the air. Thank you very much for calling in.
Yeah, howdy. How you doing?
Good.
I wanted to, about internet being classified as a utility. If I'm in the middle of a raging snowstorm and my power goes out, my heat stops, my life is sort of in jeopardy to a certain extent. I have fireplaces, but my water goes out. Things like that. Then I'm in jeopardy. If my internet goes out, not so much. These guys are in business to make money. Classifying them as a utility doesn't seem to fit.
Well, and Jim, I really appreciate the point. And we just touched on this earlier, Professor Crawford, but yes, let's return to it. I mean, is it an exaggeration to say, you know, internet access is as important as water?
Well, we don't classify things as utilities based on their necessity. We classify them as utilities because they're inputs into every part of economic life. Phone company service was a utility. No one seems to be upset about that. This is now the substitute for phone service. And it is becoming a part of every aspect of our economic and social life. So, you know, taxis, for example, are not necessary in New York City. They're treated as a utility and regulated because we want to make sure that everyone has equal access to them. Same with bus service. There's really no difference between that kind of transport service and internet access today.
What's the economic cost of the United States not being as up to speed as other countries, again, you know, Norway, Japan, France, South Korea? I mean, eventually, is there an economic disadvantage in this country, and we start to fall behind?
That's so interesting. And we've seen that kind of calculation made with respect to, say, CO2 production, that by not fixing climate change in America, we're actually burdening our ability to do well in the global economy. We don't have that number for high-speed internet access yet. One reason is that we need more resources into research in this area to count it up. But I'll tell you, on my visits to South Korea and Stockholm, they look at me open-mouthed and say, what are you guys up to? We don't think your internet access is even 21st century. You're not in the game at this point.
Well, thanks a lot for the call, Jim. I appreciate the point. Here's a similar point, but on the other side, from David in Amherst. He says, why not regard the internet infrastructure just the same as public roadways? And then Robert in Epsom says, please talk about bundling of services, that is phone, mm-hmm. television, and internet, and separate availability of each service on cable versus DSL. I remember when this bundling first came about, and my husband and I kind of looked at it and said, yeah, I guess we should do that.
It's like a big game of jump rope in which you're sort of constantly trying to catch the rope and figure out where you are. The bundling of pay TV with high-speed internet access, and particularly the practice of many companies of charging more for internet access alone than for the bundle of paid television services plus internet access, means that the barriers to entry, the ability of any new infrastructure provider to show up, are increased constantly. Comcast, for example, because it's so big, pays much less for programming than any other internet access provider in America. Any new wire provider to satisfy our desire for TV would have to enter two markets at once, both the market for programming, where it's going to pay a lot more per customer, and build new infrastructure. So bundles are ways of keeping competition at bay and making it very difficult for Americans to compare prices, apples to apples, you know, phone service to phone service, internet access service to internet access service. That's what's going on.
Well, and regarding Jim's call and your point about making internet access like a public utility, you know, some people who reviewed the book, Professor Crawford, said even those who liked the idea, the Wall Street Journal didn't like the idea, but others did. But even those who liked the idea said, this just isn't going to happen. What do you think?
Well, most of that is based on sort of conventional wisdom that we are at this point incapable of thinking of internet access as a regulated public service. I think that can change as mayors across the country understand that their citizens need fiber access and they build out these fiber networks. Chattanooga, Tennessee, Lafayette, Louisiana, Chicago, Illinois, they're all thinking and building fiber networks. And then the rest of the country will be jealous, and then the federal government will finally get its act together. But at the moment, the political push from the access providers is so strong to avoid any form of oversight that it does seem like a distant prospect.
All right. Well, in just a moment, I'd love to ask you a little bit more about those alternative local networks, also about some of the politics of this, and we'll take a lot more of your comments. So stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Western powers weigh responses to Russia's possible next moves. Then Jane Fonda on her new book about teenage sexuality and development. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather mostly sunny today, turning less windy as the day goes on. Today's highs upper 20s north, ranging upper 30s in the south. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Tarm Biomass and Lime, supplying high-efficiency wood and wood pellet heating for homes and commercial applications while encouraging the use of local renewable fuel sources, woodboilers.com. And Black Trumpet, a dining destination on the harbor in Portsmouth dedicated to bringing guests closer to the food and community of the New Hampshire seacoast, blacktrumpetbistro.com. 940, this is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Today in The Exchange, net neutrality and the telecom industry. We're talking with Susan Crawford. She's author of the new book, Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. NHPR Exchange, all one word. So, Professor Crawford, before we go back to our listeners, a little bit more, please, on these alternative networks that cities around the country are building. You mentioned Chattanooga. I think you mentioned Louisville. So how does this work? How are these mayors or these communities able to afford these alternative networks?
Well, most of these mayors feel they can't afford not to do it, that this is like electrification of their cities. And they see the benefit of not being stuck in the vice grip of an incumbent's desire to make more money from what feels to them like a utility. So what they do is get financing, patient capital, to lay down conduit, which are just big open tubes, and make sure that there are fibers running through them that serve businesses and citizens. I grew up in the town of Santa Monica, west of Los Angeles, and there the CIO over about 10 years, the chief information officer, made sure that Santa Monica had a robust fiber network serving all of its businesses. He's now able to extend that service to people in their residences in the city. It's changing the economic aspect of Santa Monica over time.
So these cities that set up these fiber networks, they make the investment, and it acts like an economic engine. You know, come to our town. We've got South Korea-style internet access. You get that young demographic, too, that cities seem to be all hoping to attract.
Oh, absolutely. We're in a competition to be global citizens, and you want young people to come, stay. You also want people to stay in rural areas and not have to leave because the connectivity is so poor. So this has helpful payoffs in all parts of the country.
Well, so here we are in New Hampshire, and we got that call earlier from Robin in Dublin, who told us that Fairpoint wouldn't go to the end of the road where she lives. So how do these sort of micro fiber networks that small cities are building, how does that help someone like Robin, who's sort of, you know, out in the country and liking being there, I'm sure?
There's an economic case for fiber to her home as well as for fiber in New York City. You just have to find the right actor who's willing to take it on, work very collaboratively with their local city. There's a lot of this going on in Vermont. Vermont seems to be a leader in municipal fiber and rural fiber efforts. And there are people gathering all over the country sharing wisdom about how to get this done and the best methods for driving down cost and raising money. Look, this isn't that complicated. It's just dirt and conduit and fiber. The real barrier is financing. And if you rely on sort of Wall Street's predictions of what this is supposed to pay back and how quickly, you won't build it. But if you see it as a bridge or a road, just as basic infrastructure, it absolutely pays for itself in terms of economic growth and productivity and social cohesion in your area.
Well, we've got a lot of listeners in Vermont. It might be nice to hear from someone who lives in one of these communities where this is happening. Last question, then we have lots of listeners who want to jump in on our conversation, Professor Crawford. So are these, again, local fiber networks that you talk about, like the one in Santa Monica, your hometown, are these nonprofits? Are they local government agencies? Are they private businesses? What are they?
There's a whole mix of models, and if your listeners are interested, there's a site called muninetworks.org, which collects case studies and reports about the more than 400 municipal networks now in place in the United States. Often, though, I mean, the salient point is that the local government instrumentality has to have an oversight role. Perhaps shouldn't itself be running the network. That's not necessarily what governments are good at, but making sure that it remains available at a reasonable cost to people on a fair and non-discriminatory basis. Look, this is all about a public good, just like electricity and water, something that only public oversight produces in a fair way for all of society.
Real interesting. All right. I could ask you five more questions on this, but I want to share you with our audience. Let's go to Reeve in Wolfboro. Hi, Reeve. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Hello. Good morning. An analogy I haven't heard that this sounds like to me is like going into my public library and discovering that only AOL, you know, only a certain books are available up front, and that to get to the others, I have to trek through the woods or something. But my question is, what can citizens do? Because it sounds like such a behemoth that we're fighting. So that's my question. What can we do? And what do you see as the most important next step for citizens?
Yeah, Reeve, thanks for the question. Go ahead, Professor Crawford.
The most important thing a citizen can do is gather together with other citizens who already understand this issue, make sure that you're pooling your resources, and then go into your mayor's office and give that mayor air cover, political power, to produce this benefit for the rest of their city. This is mostly political and financial, And to the extent that a mayor feels that he or she has the support of citizens who are interested in making sure that they're part of the 21st century, they'll act. And I'll tell you, there are more and more mayors looking for this, but they're political animals, and they need to feel that their reelection will be assisted by getting this right. So make this issue an election issue. Don't put the next mayor in office who doesn't agree to work on this.
This is so interesting, though. You're talking really locally. I mean, should the average citizen even bother with his or her member of Congress? Should the average citizen even bother writing a letter to the federal communications system? Or are we're just done at the federal level? It's too entrenched and we can't move it.
It's pretty stuck at the moment. And mayors are sovereigns in ways that even the president isn't. And they're used to, whatever party they're from, they're used to providing services to constituents. That's what a mayor does. So they can get things done in a way that an average representative on the Hill really can't.
The politics of this, a little bit more if we could. Someone in your book said, if you polled all 535 members of Congress on the top five issues the country faces, telecommunications wouldn't be even in the top 100. What does this say, Professor Crawford, about your hopes for the future?
Well, that quote comes from David Cohen, who is a leading character in my book. He's the mastermind behind Comcast's government affairs operations and extraordinarily well politically connected. He recently went to the French state dinner. Does he like French food? I don't know. But it's in his interest for this to be out of the ken, the understanding, and the caring radar of people on the Hill and in the executive branch. I think that situation is beginning to change because as Comcast and Time Warner Cable announced they're going to merge, people are suddenly waking up and saying, how can it be? How can it be that Shamu and Godzilla get to work together? Surely that's too far. And so I'm seeing more and more reporters write about this, and people look around their local city stirring, saying this seems wrong. Also, the Google Fiber installations are helping us get away from our poverty of imagination when it comes to what's possible with fiber and with less expensive connections.
Let's go next to Scott in Henniker. Hi, Scott. You're on the air. Welcome.
Well, hi, Laura, and thank you. And hello, Susan Crawford. It's awesome to have you here. I read your book last year, and it was one of the most best research I've ever seen. I've done a little bit of work with my town as a selectman and as a planning commission member in looking into this issue. And I just wanted you to be aware that there's a lot going on in New Hampshire to address those issues. And many people know about your book. The Regional Planning Commission up in the Upper Valley just introduced a draft plan for broadband. University of New Hampshire Cooperative Extension has been a big part of that. And the Central Region has put together a conference in May to talk about broadband. And so I can tell you, the troops are massing. I'll put it that way.
Well, Scott, can I ask you a quick question?
Hello?
Can I ask you a quick question, Scott? Yeah.
Yes.
No, can I ask you a question, please? And
sure.
Pardon me for not knowing. I remember hearing about the UNH effort. When you say broadband, you're talking the super, super lightning speed fiber that Professor Crawford's talking about?
That's part of it. But, of course, that's only the backbone. Then you go to the middle mile, then the last mile. And, the first part was to get the backbone done. It's been successful in some areas. In the western part of the state, they've got Fast Roads, which is, as Susan mentioned, is a municipal program that got high-speed internet from Bridge all the way up to Orford, and it's still being built out. But then, of course, it's the last mile, the one that's going to take all the work. I think all the ideas that she brings up are all very important to remember, that each individual municipality really has to look at what's going to work for them, with the funding, with the process, and all the other options that are out there. And the draft plan just released by the Upper Valley really does a great job of just showing what the options are and maybe where to go with them.
Sure, and funding is always an issue, Scott, as you well know. Thanks a lot for the call. Do you want to quickly comment, Professor Crawford?
Well, I thought that it was great to hear, and it's absolutely true that this is a local matter. What I'm hoping for is that people build for the future and not for immediate needs. Because even in the last mile, relying solely on wireless, for example, or on copper, won't get you in the global competition, which is where all Americans should be and where we were with our telephone system.
So don't bother with copper. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. In the last mile.
Yeah, and that is that fabled last mile that we keep getting back to. I wanted to ask you about something else, too. What about the idea, Professor Crawford, that everything's going wireless anyway? Technologies are changing so rapidly. In 5 years, maybe this whole cable company oligarchy or monopoly, whatever you want to call it, concerns about net neutrality. This is all going to be moot in 5 years. It's all wireless.
Well, you can't have an airplane system without airports. 95% of any wireless connection is a wire. So these two issues are absolutely complementary with an E. If the deeper you drive fiber into a community, the better wireless connectivity you're going to have. But without those wires deep in there, you're going to be stuck with a second-class connection and unable to do what people can do with wires in their home.
Let's take one more call if we could. This is Nicholas in Durham. Hi, Nicholas. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to take part, and I appreciated all the comments and illuminations that Professor Crawford's made. I'm the director of the Wireless Systems Laboratory at the University of New Hampshire Department of Electrical and Communications, specifically working on rural broadband technologies for wireless communications. And I'd just like to highlight the point that Susan just made, that, in fact, it's important to drive the fiber as far as we can. But I also wanted to illuminate the point that there is work going on actively in the state to negotiate some of the actual rural challenges that are providing or creating for us to get the fiber to those places. There is also the Broadband Center of Excellence that's going on at UNH also that is letting us do that.
No, Nicholas, we've talked about rural challenges a lot this hour, and for sure New Hampshire has many, many lovely rural pockets. But Vermont, to me, seems even more rural. So what do you think they're doing right that we're not doing yet?
You know, that's a really good question. I think part of it is that their actual distances to the fiber is actually closer than we have in New Hampshire, but I could be wrong there. I also think that they have more public funding available for broadband access.
Because they have sales and income tax in Vermont? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Nicholas, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Professor Crawford, any thoughts there? And then I got a couple last questions for you.
No, it's great to hear about all the work going on in New Hampshire, and there's so many heroes in this story. There are people in every state making sure that this issue gets fixed.
You talked earlier about the pending merger of Comcast and Time Warner Cable, a prospect you're clearly aghast at, Professor Crawford, given that these are the two giants. So if they merge, how much of the internet access market do they control if they become one?
Well, if they become one, they will then be present for 70% of American households, three-quarters almost. And what that means is that anybody in those areas who's now subscribing to DSL is a potential Comcast customer, and they will have the only high-capacity connection for most Americans. And it boggles the mind. It's actually breathtaking that one company would be able to dictate the form of information and news and entertainment and creativity, connectivity, all of this without any form of public oversight or competition. That seems dazzling to me. And I do understand that the winds are now blowing against the merger. But it merely takes a terrible situation and makes it incrementally worse. We were already in a hole. This just would dig the hole a little deeper.
So the merger is pending before the Federal Communications Commission? Is that where it is right now? Or how does that work?
Yes, we're in the very early stages of what's likely to be a year-long process. So we have a lot of time to gather steam on this one. It looks like the Department of Justice will also be reviewing it for antitrust concerns. The FCC's role here is to look at the public interest, what public interest values are undermined by a merger like this. The Senate is also announcing hearings it will hold to try to hold the company's feet to the fire as we go through this process. But it's been well greased by Comcast and their deep political connections at every level of government, local, state, and federal.
Well greased, meaning campaign contributions.
Well, it's softer than that. It's not direct pay for play. They're much classier than that. They make a lot of donations to nonprofits that then stand up and are perhaps the pet nonprofits of the representatives involved. They hire chiefs of staff who used to work for the representatives or senators. They even hired a Federal Communications Commission commissioner who had voted for the Comcast-NBCU merger in 2011. After she voted for it, she became a Comcast employee. And David Cohen has been quoted as joking, well, if I haven't hired anybody, just let me know.
Wow. Well, what about the state's attorneys general? Do they have a role in this at all? I mean, as you said, this is a national level, but it affects people in the states.
Yes. Thanks for mentioning that. A bunch of state attorneys general have recently announced that they'll be looking hard at the Comcast-Time Warner Cable merger. They have a role in protecting consumers. Their protection authority is essential, and they're worried primarily about exactly the issue we're focusing on in this call, which is high-speed internet access. Not pay TV, not video, but this essential utility function that all of their citizens need and that is pretty high-priced and pretty second-class.
Well, and we heard from our own attorney general's office yesterday that New Hampshire is joining other states in looking at this. Nobody's saying we're filing a suit or anything like that, but New Hampshire's AG is going to be looking at this pending Time Warner Comcast merger as it moves forward. What do you think, Professor Crawford, where are we going to be 3 years from now on this? Let's say the merger doesn't go through. Are we going to be in a better era than we are now?
I think in 3 years, we'll have a growing patchwork of municipal and rural systems that shame everybody else into action. This doesn't happen quickly. This is the root canal of policy. It takes a while, but we'll get it done.
All right. Professor Crawford, what a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. What a joy to be here.
Susan Crawford, visiting professor at Harvard Law School, author of the book Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. She's also a columnist for Bloomberg View, part of Bloomberg News. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Alan Cohen. Our intern is James Puglia. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. The Granite State makes national headlines, becoming the 26th state to approve Medicaid expansion. Vice President Joe Biden visits New Hampshire, praising our job training programs and his fellow Democrats in the state. And a long, cold winter has meant a slow and disappointing start for maple syrup producers. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, the Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 o'clock. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Currier Museum of Art in Manchester, presenting Romare Bearden, A Black Odyssey, an alternative take on Homer from this talented African-American artist. Details at courier.org. And the Co-op Food Stores of Hanover, Lebanon, and White River Junction announcing their annual meeting on April 5th. Details at coopfoodstore.coop.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. In a speech yesterday in The Hague, President Obama pointedly denounced Russia's annexation of Crimea, and he said he does not want to see events between Russia and the West as signaling the start of a new Cold War. The speech ended the president's week.